I'm Gene, and this is Perfect Flow. I'm a New Zealand-based athlete and coach focused on optimizing performance, health, and well-being. While I have a professional background in biomedical engineering, I've chosen to follow my more immediate passions for running, endurance, adventure, movement, nutrition, lifestyle, community, psychology, and personal growth. My goal in starting this podcast is to connect with bright minds to extract the information I need to live a life that makes sense and feels good, and share those conversations with others. Apart from your favorite podcast app, the best places to follow my work are perfectflow.nz, genebeverage.nz, and Perfect Flow on Facebook. Hey, welcome back. Gene here. Hope you guys are well. Today I have another podcast on orienteering. I'm here in Norway with the New Zealand orienteering team, and of course all the other national teams are hanging around, and I managed to snaffle a top athlete and friend from the Swiss team, Martin Hubman. You've probably, if you followed orienteering at any stage in the past 10 years, you'll be familiar with that name, Hubman. Martin is the younger brother of Daniel, who's one of the most well-medaled elite runners on the scene at the moment, about to start his 50th race at WOC. I'm talking with his younger brother, who often flies in the shadow of Daniel's fame, but Martin is an incredible athlete in his own right, and was so from a young age, as you'll find out, and it was really cool for me to pick his brains for a little while. This podcast did seem very short to me. We had a short window of opportunity that we seized, and it was great that we could get anything recorded at all, given that we're not staying together, and of course really here to focus on our performance and being part of a national team. We had a short window just before the opening ceremony and managed to get a quick recording, so I hope you enjoy hearing a little bit about Martin, and you can check out his website, and we can follow him, and of course some links to World Champs, which is just getting underway tomorrow, on the blog post associated with this podcast. So I hope you enjoy another podcast on orienteering, and I bring you Martin Hubman. Martin, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you.
Cool. So what makes you more nervous? Been recorded talking or starting the race? Races coming up.
No, I'm nervous about my English skills.
Yeah, so far.
And, I don't know, what are you going to ask me?
Yeah, well, we'll see where it goes. Of course, I've followed your racing fairly closely for the past, I guess, 10 years maybe. But I don't really know what happened before then, so I'm actually quite keen to go back even further and hear about how you got into orienteering and what it's like in Switzerland growing up, being pulled into the junior elite scene and then being propelled forwards, and also hearing a little bit about how it was in the wake of your brother, of course, who was going through some years before you, and maybe expectations around your performance. And yeah, so let's wind it right back. How did you get into orienteering?
Yeah, as you said, my older brother, mm-hmm. and my other brother as well, like I have two older brothers, they do orienteering, still do, and the middle one not on that high level as Danny and me doing, but that's how I got into it. And actually my parents didn't do orienteering, so they just let us do what we want to. It was just it has to be something. They don't have to drive us somewhere.
Okay.
So it has to be something close to where we live. And I actually tried some other sports like soccer, athletics, and a little bit gymnastics.
Gymnastics, interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Gymnastics, not in a professional way, but...
But I imagine athletics and football are fairly common, fairly standard sports at school in Switzerland.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like all the other... My schoolmates, they went to soccer, they went to athletics or play mm-hmm. tennis or something. So I really loved sport in general, and I still would like to do more beside orienteering than just yeah, running and orienteering. But yeah, in the end, I had to decide on one sport if I wanted to become really good.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to.
Okay, and when was that age where you had to drop the other sports?
I was like 16. With 16, I decided, all right, the orienteering had priority.
Okay.
And before, there were some years I actually prioritized the athletics competition.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow, orienteering competitions were more fun, and I was also more getting more successful. And mm-hmm. in athletics, I was maybe I was too small.
Yeah, you were finding just some natural predisposition.
Yeah, the guys in my age, they were much taller and making much more mm-hmm. progress than me.
Yep. Just on that note, have you found that you've kind of caught up at all? Was that just because with guys and they go through growth spurt and you can see some of them are maturing, you know, 2 years earlier than others, and it makes a big difference when you're 16, depending on how much you've developed physically. Do you think you've kind of caught up, or do you feel there are some things in athletics that you just still don't have the right composition for?
Yeah, that's a difficult question.
Yeah, it's hard to know, but I mean, if you're doing like a 5K or something, I imagine you're fairly well built.
Yeah, I mean, athletics in the years with 12 to 16, I was really doing everything, like high jump, long jump, and hurdles. So really basic athletics and not just running.
Yeah, right.
So I think that was fun.
Yeah, I think that's my recollection as well. I just like touched athletics, and basically the only thing I ever liked doing was running. And even at that age, the races you do are quite short as well. You've got to be quite powerful.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just remember everyone being so much stronger. I said, this is no fun. This is absolutely no fun. Let's go back to the forest.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then what was schools orienteering like in Switzerland?
Yeah. And it's not really known.
Okay.
Or like when I was going to school, it actually started with the world champs in Switzerland 2003.
Okay.
We also started with the school education to have orienteering inside the lessons. And
so is that to say it's more of a club sport in Switzerland? Or is it just that it's really small in general?
It's really a club sport. And usually if you don't have a teacher, don't know anything about orienteering, you don't get a touch of orienteering. Mm.
Do you notice some schools will grow quite a lot in the people at that school that do orienteering just because there's people in the club there? Or do people not even connect through school to do orienteering? Like, do you pull your school friends into orienteering at all?
Yeah. I remember that we had some orienteering lessons in school, but I was the only one into it and all the others tried. And the basic answer, if someone says, yeah, I know orienteering, then it's like, oh no, don't talk about that.
Okay.
I'm so bad in that. And I messed it up at this race in the school. And they have, usually they connect orienteering with quite bad memories, bad experience, because they couldn't handle the map and made mistakes. So it wasn't fun.
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely a hurdle,
and
an early hurdle to overcome.
Yeah. And actually, I know only one person who got through the school into orienteering.
Mm-hmm.
That's my girlfriend.
Okay.
So she really is someone who, get to know orienteering about school in school.
Sweet. And then at what stage in Switzerland do you start becoming interested in competing for European junior or junior world championships?
Well, my first European youth championship was with 16.
Okay.
That was the first time. The first time I traveled actually abroad a little bit far away than just the neighborhood countries. So it was the first time I took a plane. With 16 and with orienteering.
Sweet. And was that an experience you expected to be competitive at? Or was this very much just a first taste that got you going?
No, I was already really I had success in Switzerland already with 12 years old in orienteering. So it was not like I started with orienteering with 16. So it really started with 9, 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And I won my first Swiss champ in with 12. So I was always competitive throughout the whole junior.
And is that similar to Daniel as well?
Yes.
Yeah,
it's kind of the same.
Mm-hmm. And what's the age difference?
He didn't try any other sports.
Okay. He was just in love from the start.
Yeah.
And what's the age difference between you two?
6 years.
Okay. Sweet. And when was your first time racing Jaywalk? And can you tell me about the structure of the junior elite squad or how it is in Switzerland?
Yeah. compared to Scandinavia, it's a different setup. So when you get into an age of 14, 15, and you're one of the best in your region in Switzerland. So we have like six different regions which have a squad. And then they ask you to join. And then you are basically in a squad. You have some organized training camp. Like every year, free training camp, mm-hmm. for example, and some weekends you train together. So that's the first step. And then the goal is from that squad to get better and to make the step to the junior national team.
Okay.
And that's in an age of 17 or 18. And I made the step with 17. And that mm-hmm. was my first Jaywalk year.
Cool.
Of 17.
Cool. And what did it feel like to you, if you can think back that far? Was that a very nerve-wracking experience going to the experiencing the skills of all these other orienteers throughout Europe? Or had you been traveling around Scandinavia enough to realize that little Switzerland is now up against some pretty strong Scandinavian countries? Did you know what you're up against at that stage?
Since I've been racing only the year before, my first European Youth Championship in Czech Republic, it was only 1 year later I got to Jaywalk the first time. And with 17, it's quite early. Also for Switzerland, usually it's with 18 or 19.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow I was a big talent then, and they gave me the chance to run in Lithuania, Jaywalk, and I didn't have that high expectations, and it was kind of a lesson and just to collect experience,
mm-hmm.
and my position were around 50th place,
mm-hmm.
so I was far behind the best.
Mm. Do you remember those feelings from that first Jaywalk?
Yeah.
Were you extremely nervous?
I still remember quite well.
Yeah. How was it?
For example, you probably can't imagine anymore that the Swiss team had only one guy making the A final in the middle distance.
Right. Yeah.
I was only 1 second away.
Yeah.
But I didn't make it either. Yeah. So it was hard to believe or to see like others in my age. For example, Søren Bobach is the same age as me, and he won the middle distance with 17.
Right. Yeah,
and I felt like, wow, that's amazing. I mean, it's my age, and I couldn't have imagined to be up there.
Mm-hmm.
I had no chance, and somehow I almost didn't believe that I could make it to the really top.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. You kind of assume that those who are at the top have just been like, you know, super, just believed it their whole life and always lived it. But yeah, there's always a stage where you're now the small fish in the big pond as you move up.
Yeah.
How did that feel after that first Jaywalk? Was the motivation really high, or did you believe that you could do the training required?
Well, of course, maybe my... my brother's success helped me to believe in it.
Mm-hmm.
somehow I must have the same gene.
yeah, I suspect there's some, man. I suspect there's some.
I just liked to do the orienteering and Jaywalk was always a huge event and such big fun, and I wanted to be back in Jaywalk the year after, and mm-hmm. so I made it the three next Jaywalks as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I was always making step by step.
Yeah.
And actually the next year I already won a bronze medal
mm-hmm.
in Australia.
Yeah. That's really cool.
So that was surprising.
Okay, you felt that was a bit of a surprise?
Yeah.
Did you feel that your training after that first Jaywalk was a step up because you knew where the standard was? Or did you just keep chipping away doing what you enjoy?
Yeah, it was probably the second. And
yeah.
It was also the terrain, which was new for everyone.
Right.
Especially for Scandinavians.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a kind of the different approach to the terrain, and Lithuania is somehow quite similar to the Scandinavian terrain.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a little disadvantage there, I think.
Yeah, that's really cool. Really seize the opportunity. How did you do what did you get bronze in Australia?
In the middle.
How were you at the long distance at that stage? Were you still noticing that physical gap between you and the top guys in the long distance?
Yeah, I think so. Well, I came 10th, so I was, I was always an all-rounder, so I had quite basic result, consistent result in all the distances. For example, Australia was always in the top 10.
Mm-hmm.
And in my last Jaywalk year, I was always in the top 4
mm-hmm.
in every race. So it never looked like I will become like a sprinter as I was the last years in the elite class.
Yeah. Has that still borne out? Are you still following that kind of feel, or do you feel like you're specialized? Because I noticed previously at WOC, you've done a lot of sprints at WOC, but is that just more the selection of the Swiss team,
or
is that
being
your emphasis? Okay.
So I used to train as an all-rounder all year, and it's just because, in the Swiss team, I didn't make it to another race in the forest. It was only the sprint I got. So it was only those 1 or 2 months just before WOC I really specialized.
Mm-hmm.
On sprint only.
Okay. So going back to those final two Jaywalks for you, so you've had some taste of glory, but not quite victory yet.
Mm.
Do you take a different attitude with preparation for those final Jaywalks? Are you starting to be more specific in your preparation?
More specific. I was never taking the opportunity to go to Scandinavia, for example, to have some months training there or like an exchange year, like many other Central Europe runners do. That's also because I was working and didn't have the opportunity just because of time. So I was just following the team, the junior national team program. And we basically have one camp before Jaywalk in this terrain, and that was basically the preparation.
Mm-hmm.
That looks quite differently now. We invest much more time in this terrain where world champs will be.
Cool. And was that this kind of same with everyone else? The standard of preparation was slightly lower, or were the Scandinavian countries kind of already going hard at that stage with the training camps and stuff?
When you compare with the Scandinavians, they are really in the early junior years really strong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's probably because they train much more amount in the early years compared to us. So I think we have a little different approach. Like we start on a lower level.
Okay. How does that approach feel? Yeah, to describe it to me as a junior, what the pathway is, how is it laid out for you in Switzerland?
The studies or the basics are quite small, or we don't know a lot of we don't have a lot of data,
mm-hmm.
who is training what and things like that, or we didn't have that 10 years ago. But now it all started with online training data book.
Okay.
So everyone is using that in Switzerland, mm-hmm. Which is in the national team.
Mm-hmm.
So and we started to collect the data and so somehow finding a guideline for the youngsters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's quite nice. It's just, I think we have a little order of philosophy than the Scandinavians.
Mm-hmm.
They just train usually quite much more amount of training. Mm-hmm. So, basically, in a low intensity running,
mm-hmm.
they do much more than we do.
Yep. And did you feel that was noticeable at those results for you while you were at JWOC? How was the Swiss team doing? Because now it seems Switzerland and Sweden and Norway are all very similar with their medals or top 10s or however you want to count it at Junior World Champs. Whereas 10 years ago, did Switzerland slot in below the Scandinavian countries?
The success become better, I think. You always had like my brother and Matthias Mertz, many other guys. They have been already successful as a junior, so they won medals and gold medals. So it's not like the success wasn't there 10 years ago, but it became much wider, more runners in the team could have won a medal.
Mm-hmm.
But also this year we saw that the Swiss team didn't win as much medal as we are used to. So I think, it was only one medal. And I guess it's always a little bit an up and down. And
How were your results in your final JWOC?
My results?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was third in long, fourth in middle, third in sprint, and second in the relay. So no, that was good last JWOC year.
That's really, really consistent.
And I think in the in the early or in the junior class, you get also much advantage because of the terrain.
Mm-hmm.
Because you haven't been traveling so much and you don't know all the terrains and all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in Italy and that was similar to Swiss terrain and that suited us well.
Yep. So you're really confident going into those races.
Yeah, exactly.
Sweet.
So the year before it was in Sweden and I didn't win any medal.
Mm-hmm. That's a noticeable trend, especially as a junior. Yeah, you're right there. They are just really well honed to their own terrain. So how does that set the progression for you moving forward as a really successful junior in Switzerland? What's the step forward? Because, I mean, the elite level, the senior elite level in Switzerland is so high. So how does that feel coming through as a top junior? Do you slot right in or is there still a gap that you have to bridge?
For me, it was definitely a gap.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't make it to the World Champs the first 3 years. So that was kind of hard to keep up and to stay motivated,
mm-hmm.
to just do the work and train and finally hope you will make it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there have been always some smaller competitions you could run, like European Champs, World Cup races to collect experience. But I think, until now, now I'm 30 years old and... it's my first walk forest race I will run in 2 days.
Yeah.
So it took a long time until I made it. So it's always a little bit between a nice to have such a strong team to get better,
mm-hmm.
but also frustration to not have more chances.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you've got one end of the extreme and I've got the other end of the extreme where I can travel to walk most years that I wish to travel, but back home, man, I wish I could be over here just training with people who are so much better than you and keep that momentum. So how do those 10 years pan out for you? Did you just have a season by season goal? What is your training philosophy through each season?
As I said, I was training as an all-rounder, so I want to become good in all distances, in all type of terrain. So I was focusing always on the next walk, actually. But also in a long term to increase the training amount, because that was the point where I had to close the gap the first three senior years.
Oh, yep.
Due to my work I did until 20 years old, I wasn't able to increase my training every year. It even decreased the last 2 years as a junior.
Okay.
But still I was successful. And then I had to get up on a higher amount of training. And it was that time where I got close to my limits and also felt like some injury are just around the corner.
Right. So
I somehow managed to go around and I think that was the main reason it took some years until I got to the World Elites class.
Cool. And zooming in a little bit more, what does your training look like?
Like now?
What are your secrets? Have you had coaches over this time, or are you self-directing?
A fun fact is that Danny, my brother, was my coach as a junior.
Yeah.
But when I changed to the Elite class,
it
was like, how should we continue?
Yeah, now he's
your
rival.
And he felt like, maybe I'm becoming someday better than him. So it was actually his coach asked me if I would be happy to have him as a coach as well. So I thought that's a really nice idea. Mm-hmm. And we changed the situations that I had the same coach as Danny has.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still the same until now.
Yeah. And is he an orienteer?
Yeah, he is. Okay. And he has kids who's all orienteers.
Okay. So the advice he's given you is not just with your physical training. This is
no,
with technique
it's actually
as well?
Especially in technical and mental things.
So not physical?
No. It's of course he has some education in training philosophy and but I think it's more about experience he learned from other athletes. And in the end, it was kind of the same philosophy than he has with Danny. And and it's maybe the important point was always for us that, we have to do as much as orienteering as we can. And it's not that important which type of interval you do. And
is that a number you track over the years, the amount of orienteering hours that you get done in a season? Or you're
how
just
many
trying
hours?
To yeah, have you yeah. ever tracked that, or are you just trying to push as much
yeah,
as you can?
I tracked it all over the since I'm 14 I have all the datas.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, a reminder to anyone listening.
If you want to know any datas, I'm not sure if I have it in my mind. It's not like, now I had 150 hours orienteering and now it should be 200 or something like that. But I think it's over a year, it's like around 30%. So it's like a one-third of the running amount I do orienteering.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's quite a lot.
Yep.
Of course, if you compare with Scandinavians, they do probably even more.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, that's quite good for Switzerland. So is that largely because where you live is quite close proximity to a lot of orienteering maps? Because a lot of people outside of Scandinavia would definitely struggle to get to 30%.
No, you can say that we Swiss train, when we are home, we train basically in physical shape.
Yeah.
And orienteering is not that exciting where we live.
Mm-hmm.
most of us, so you don't have many maps, or when you have maps, you don't, you know them too well. And we invest basically in training camps, and we have a lot of them.
Right.
So when we go to training camp, then we train
orienteering. You're getting a big week of like 90% orienteering.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's really cool. And your progression into the senior elite team, was there a gap in training camps, or did you have training camps as a junior and then your first year as a senior, you were in senior training camps? Or is there a gap where you're left to fight?
No, it's... No. Yeah, I switched straight to elite, the elite national team.
And are then there people who drop off? Are there people who get to junior and are not good enough for the senior team? Yeah. I imagine that's quite a hard place to
really
be.
Yeah, that's really hard to make the team again.
Yeah.
And for example, my girlfriend is in this situation now, and she's trying to get in this team. And that's really, that's a good point, actually, because it's in the last year we have been discussing a lot how to develop for them to have some opportunity to join camps.
Yeah.
So nowadays they are allowed to join like two camps throughout the year. So they pay a little amount to join the camps.
Otherwise that's really hard to play catch
because
up
otherwise
on your
own. You have to organize all yourself, and of course you can do that together with a Scandinavian club, and that's always a good connection as well.
Going back to some of your training philosophy or the structure of your training, have you over the years developed would you feel like an orienteering technique that's slightly different to other people? Have you paid much attention to characterizing your technique or being able to articulate it to other people? I know there's a lot of people who are just incredibly talented juniors and perhaps don't realize how good they are at navigation until maybe, I think often it takes until your mid-20s when you can actually explain your orienteering a little bit better. Your orienteering was obviously amazing as a junior in those final few years. Did you understand what made the difference on those years, or you were just doing what you were good at? Could you have articulated your technique as a junior?
Yeah, well, as a junior, we were working a lot on the mental and technical things in the junior national team. So that's where I started to think about how I do orienteering. Before, I was just doing and as good as I can and didn't think about anything. But when I started to think about how I do, I also find some points to improve. And I would say like in those years, like 18 until 23, I was investing quite a lot in those mental, technical.
What kind of things did you uncover?
Let's to think back.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a person who who's doing much when you relocate, when you just run and try to catch things on the terrain, and you try to find them on the
So kind of like a retrospective orienteering.
Like Danny and me are quite the same in those kind of technical orienteering. And that works usually quite good, and if it works, it's fast. But sometimes you come you get into these situations where you don't understand anymore where you are. And that's something I try to learn how to relocate faster. To focus on the main features on the map and not on details.
In order to do that well, you have to have a fairly strong compass. Your direction has to be fairly steady. Otherwise, was that something you were always just very disciplined with?
Yeah, that's something we Hoopman brothers are really strong in.
Okay.
And I can't really explain.
Because it's a bit of discipline to always always have the habit of pulling up and recorrecting all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, it's about also trusting your skills. Yeah, that you are able to run straight on.
Yep. And you don't feel this like overwhelming concern when you're kind of missing some features. I know a lot of us that we're as soon as we start missing features, we become
stressed.
Yeah, a little bit stressed. Yeah. And then our direction gets worse because we're grasping, hopefully, for things. And you feel like you just steer the course. And
I try to stay on the direction and try to just catch something on the way before I stop.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. And yeah, it's really the more I talk to other orienteers and in this format, you see just how differently some of us do navigate. And it's always a response to our own issues as a junior. We finally figure out what's holding us back. And yeah, it's different for everyone. Does that fit with a style for more than just Daniel and yourself? Is there a general theme in the way they coach the Swiss national team, or is there quite a big spread across people's style?
I think the idea the coaches want to tell us is more like be prospective.
Mm-hmm.
So not getting into the risky situations you don't have any plan anymore. So yeah, it's maybe a little bit different than I sometimes try to do orienteering.
Yeah.
But
the coaches do have a philosophy that they will teach first, as opposed to teaching the options. They will.
Yeah, teach I think the first the approach is always being prospective.
Yeah.
Know what you're going to see.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it's. You have to have a mix of both if you want to be fast.
Yeah, and...
In the right moment...
Definitely in the right moment, you have to relocate,
and that's something I was not good at in the beginning.
Right, so...
Or maybe in the beginning of daily class.
So a small error turns into a massive error.
Yes, exactly. Danny was already really good and relocate really fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I also noticed that during sometimes some easy runs together with him, that he relocate really fast. Ah, that's the road we came from there. And for me, it was like, whoa, that was quick.
Yeah,
and okay. I used a little more time to relocate.
And was there a conscious thought process to the relocation? Is there like a little checklist you go through?
Yeah, I tried actually, but, it's never, that concept never really, established in my brain.
Yeah.
So the concept was more like, yeah, where was my last certain point?
Mm-hmm.
I knew where I was, and is the direction correct? And you know, and you had to stop. But that's something I can't do it. It's
okay. It just didn't
I always continue running and try to relocate on the way.
Mm-hmm.
But I got better just because I do more like prospective orienteering.
Okay.
So I have a plan from control to control.
Okay.
And before I was more like, compass, and then I will relocate somewhere.
Right.
But now I had the feeling, where is the decisive moment to relocate?
Okay. But you're still spending large portions looking through the terrain before you pull the feature onto the map.
Yeah, like the key passages, for example.
Right, but you've planned the key passages,
to pass.
Mm-hmm. But then you're running hard and you're seeing the key feature and then finding it on the map when you get to it, or do you know exactly where it's going to be before you can see it?
Yeah, it's more like I'm finding on the map those key passages and then trying to hit them.
And then when you see it through the through the terrain, are you looking exactly where the hill will appear just before it appears? or are you kind of bumping into the hill?
No, then I really tried to hit the that passage I really wanted to catch. So yeah. I tried to be accurate on those key points. Yeah,
that's the hardest thing to pull off, and it seems to be the way of going really fast.
I mean, it's always a question of the terrain. I mean, it's not. Yeah, that's the cool thing in orienteering.
Yeah.
But I just have really in mind what I need in this type of terrain we are running this week.
Yeah. So specifically for the races coming up, you've spent enough time in the terrain to know what stands out.
Yes.
So you're not just choosing any old.
Yeah, of course. Feature.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have those passages through cliffs you want to catch.
Yeah.
Otherwise you lose time because of climbing and
And do you feel that the longer you spend in a particular terrain, you develop a better intuition for picking up different things? Does it become less conscious the more you practice it? Or are you still, as you're running, you're still talking to yourself to say, I need the hill, I need the cliff? How does it feel when you're out there? Are you talking to yourself quite a lot, or is it becoming semi-autonomous? Well,
I think after spending so much time in this terrain, everything works like automatically.
Okay, it's becoming like quite automatic.
You drive a car,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, that's definitely something.
But of course, that's the goal.
Yeah,
And in the beginning of a new terrain, I do it more with awareness.
Yeah.
And also with less self-confidence. Mm-hmm. And that's something really important when you train in the terrain and you gain so much self-confidence with just doing and doing again.
And how long do you think it takes to develop that sense of autonomy in a terrain like what we're facing at WOC this year? I mean, are we talking years even? I mean, you've been back across here many, many times, and then you've spent like a lot of this year actually in the terrain. At which stage did you feel, oh wow, I'm really getting the flow of this?
I think the progress starts really increase really quickly in the beginning.
Okay.
So you learn fast in the beginning, or you learn the most in the beginning. First, let's say the first month, the first 2 weeks, you make much progress, and then like the curve.
The progress becomes slower and slower.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that's all we've got time for today, but wishing you the best for the races coming up. And we'll head off to the opening ceremony now and getting another World Championships kicked off. Good luck for you in the forest. And so potentially the relay as well, if you... Do you know your relay team yet? Or is that dependent on middle and long results?
No, it's already decided.
Mm-hmm.
So if nothing happens with any of these three guys, injuries or sickness, I will be not running.
Okay.
I'm just first reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Well.
So the long distance will be probably my
single race. It's a big taste. I'll see you out there. Thanks for coming in, Martin.
Yeah,
it's been really interesting.
If you're enjoying the Perfect Flow podcast and want more value from it in the future, there are some ways you can support it. The first is to rate or leave a positive review on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or other platforms where it's available. The second is to share this podcast or specific episodes on social media or with friends. The third is to get involved more directly through the Perfect Flow page on Facebook, where I'm trying to construct a more interactive community. I want Perfect Flow to belong to the listeners, and if you tell me what topics you're most interested in, or even suggest specific guests, I'll do my best to make it happen. This is your opportunity to be part of something that answers your questions and adds value to your life. Another good reason to follow Perfect Flow on Facebook is that I post links to episodes, blog posts, and anything I find useful to this page. It's a great way to follow my training, racing, and learning. Another great way to stay engaged is to subscribe to genebeverage.nz. This way you will get podcasts and blogs emailed to you, avoiding the clutter of Facebook. I don't know where this project will take us, but the reception so far has been positive. Who knows where we might be in a few years.